each other in shul on Shabbat just a couple of days ago, so it's nice to see you in person and now here online. So vakasha, and you can take the full hour if you would like, because I'm next, so it doesn't matter if I start late. Okay.
Okay. I'm speaking in shul at 6:30 p.m., and I'm currently in my apartment, so there's a little time constraint there. So I really want to talk about the practices of Tisha B'Av, what we do on Tisha B'Av, and how we feel about what we do. And here's what I mean by that. When the question of authenticity is raised to me, I'm a high school teacher, I'm an educator. When the question of authenticity is raised with me, it generally is a question of how can I do these things if I'm not feeling them, that doesn't feel authentic, that doesn't feel true. That is, you know, the question of our era. It's a really good question, but it's not the question I'm going to talk about today. Because in the context of Tisha B'Av, when I hear that question, it's not, can I do these things even if I'm not feeling it? It doesn't feel authentic. It doesn't feel true. The question often goes the other way. I'm doing all the things. I'm still not feeling it. Am I doing it right? Or am I doing it wrong? Have I failed in my Tisha B'Av? Because after doing all the things, I sat in shul today until chatzot, I said keynote, didn't understand most of the words I said. So somebody explained them to me. Great. So now I understood the basic historical background, maybe of the keynote I was saying. Still didn't understand most of the words I said. Tried really hard to maintain not doing Hesach Hadad from the day. So I read books about the Holocaust or watched movies about the Holocaust. I tried hard to, but at the end of the day, I don't feel particularly sad. I don't feel particularly overwhelmed with grief. I certainly don't feel like crying. And so at the end of the day, am I doing Tisha B'Av wrong? Have I failed at Tisha B'Av? Because these practices of Avelut, which I'm scrupulously adhering to, are not evoking any of the feelings that it seems to me or that I've been told or that I've come to expect or that I think they're supposed to evoke. And so that question about authenticity, or maybe it's a question about success, not authenticity then, but success at Tisha B'Av maybe, is the question that I want to think about, address, and talk about a little bit today. I want to think about what are the underlying assumptions behind it, what makes us ask that question in the first place, and then I want to think about other ways we can possibly frame the experience of the day of Tisha B'Av. And I think many of these things apply more broadly to other halachic observances, but my experience myself, my kids, certainly my students and other people who speak to me, is that we experience this much more intensely around Tisha B'Av. I've never had anybody say to me, I'm doing all the things you're supposed to do about Simchat HaChag. I'm eating meat and I'm drinking wine, but I'm not feeling happy. Am I doing Chag wrong? I've never heard anybody say that to me about the Simcha on a Chag, even though Simcha on a Chag is a mitzvah midoraita, right? But nobody seems to feel like if I'm not experiencing joy, whatever that feels to me, you know, whatever that means, that somehow I'm doing Yom Tov wrong. But with Tisha B'Av, if I'm not feeling sad, then I'm worried that maybe I'm doing Tisha B'Av wrong. And so that's the conversation I want to enter us into. That's what I want to think about. And I want to start by asking, what do we think is behind that? What's the motivation behind us saying, if I don't feel sad, am I doing Tisha B'Av wrong? And the first thing I want to do is that I want to acknowledge that there is definitely a halachic impetus or halachic push behind that. The idea of individuals who have obligations to discharge and our obligations around this time of year, our obligations of Avelut, and certainly in some framings of that, that includes feeling sadness and mourning about the Korban Beit HaMikdash, about the destruction and calamities that have befallen the Jewish people. Rav Soloveitchik has a very famous essay about Avelut Yishana and Avelut Chadasha, old mourning and new mourning, in which he contrasts new mourning, which is the mourning of a personal or familial loss, which starts with an intensity of feeling, which then has to be captured or almost tamed or limited by the rules of Avelut, which say only this much and only to this extent and only for this amount of time. So that's Avelut Chadasha, the new mourning of a personal loss. And Avelut Yishana, old mourning, the older mourning of our collective national losses, which go exactly the other way. We start with the halachic actions in an attempt to engender or arouse feeling. And he points out that the timeline also goes the other way, right? With the loss of a relative, we start with the most intense period of Avelut, and then we go to a lesser and then a lesser. There's like a step down. And it's the opposite with the mourning for the Korban Beit HaMikdash, where there's an intensifying the 3 weeks and then the 9 days or Shavua Shacholbo and then Tisha B'Av itself. And so And that intensifying series of morning practices, Rav Zal Halevitchik says, is to kind of bring us along someplace that we aren't getting from that original bang of an intense emotional experience. And so instead, we have to be brought along by the halachic practices that attempt to get us to a state where they engender a certain kind of feeling. So that is by way of acknowledging that there certainly are halachic frameworks that ask of us to feel a certain way, and even that try to get us to feel a certain way. And I certainly think that that is one of the things that is behind our self-assessment, that if I haven't felt this way on Tisha B'Av, I haven't done it right or I haven't succeeded. But I would like to suggest that there's something else at work here. I don't know that for all of us, it is solely an intense scrupulosity about the particulars of halacha and a deep awareness of the way that halacha might expect us to feel something that has us wondering if we haven't felt something, if we perhaps potentially have done Tisha B'Av wrong. Instead, I want to also suggest that it is the result of a world we live in, a society we live in, a time we live in which we view things as enormously individualistic, assessed on the basis of merit, of success or failure. Did I get a, you know, I teach students, did I get 100 or an A plus on the test? Or we're at work, did I get a stellar performance review? Am I going to get the bonus? Or it's in the halachic realm. Did I win my halachic gold star by discharging all my obligations perfectly? And all those things are extremely personal and individual and atomistic. It's me alone. I alone am taking the test, and I alone am getting the performance review, and I am alone am discharging or not discharging my halachic obligations. And we look at it as, you know, I got an A or I got a B or I got a C in my halachic observance, or I won or I lost this game. So it's a very, very individual, meritocratic, how well did you prove yourself and earn stickers on a sticker chart way of thinking about our halachic observance. And I think there's a fair amount of that that comes in here as well. We in the observant Jewish community, I think, suffer from this far less than many other people in our society, because by nature we are embedded in and connected to community. But I think it afflicts us as well. Hyper-individualization, whether it's in the realm of politics or it's in the realm of religious community, I can only connect with those people or those institutions or those affiliations that exactly precisely mirror in every respect or detail exactly where I want to be, because anything else is compromising or selling out or not being true and authentic to myself. Instead of saying, maybe that's what it means to be part of a community. Maybe picking up on the last few words that I heard of the previous speaker, make it all work together, right? We all have to figure out a little bit how to not always be so insistent on being totally true to our own individual selves. I speak from the United States and I speak about the American experience. I can't tell you exactly how relevant it is to other people's experiences in other societies or communities. But I will certainly say that in this country, we are endlessly talking now for decades already about an epidemic of loneliness plaguing American adults, about enormous isolation, about declining affiliation and membership in all kinds of community groups, about declining affiliation in religious groups. That's an atomization that's bred by moving to the suburbs, spending more time in your cars. Then a generation later, it's an atomization that's bred by spending more time on your social media. But one way or another, we view this as an individual success or failure, me and how I'm being assessed. I stand alone. And I want to encourage us to think about our halachic commitments and our halachic obligations and what it means to be an observant Jew in different ways. And I want to offer us a number of different ways to think about what it means to observe Tisha B'Av, even in the absence of feeling any affective or emotional feeling of mourning, even in the absence of feeling any affective or emotional feeling of sadness. And I'll just say parenthetically, it is, of course, much easier to evoke sadness about more recent events of the Jewish past. It is much easier to evoke sadness about the Holocaust than it is about the Korban Beit HaMikdash. And while we, of course, mourn all the subsequent tragedies of Jewish history on Tisha B'Av, the essence of the day really is about the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, about the destruction of the Temple, about the loss of God's manifest presence in our world, in our society that way, about the loss of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. So all of that is what the day is essentially about, and everything else flows from that. But I think it's a little bit of a sidestep to say, yes, I can feel sad on Tisha B'Av, I can feel sad about the Holocaust, when it comes to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, I think many of us have a difficult time accessing that emotionally. So I want to talk about a few things. And since we can't seem to get away from it at all, I'm now going to talk about Moshe Kapel's book, Judaism Straight Up. Now, what do I mean we can't get away from it at all? Moshe Kapel works for a think tank in Israel, which has been spearheading, is that fair to say, on the behind the scenes coordinating, I'm not sure what the right set of English verbs is, but judicial reform in Israel. Okay, that is what he does. He works for this think tank in Israel. He also, separate from that whole endeavor, Kohelet, thank you, wrote a book called Judaism Straight Up, which is a really interesting book that I want to talk about for its strengths and the areas where it bothers me, but also its strengths. There's something else I have spoken about a number of times recently because it seems to be increasingly relevant in the society we live in, which is the question of quoting, citing, and teaching problematic people. Depending on where you land on the political spectrum, he may be a hero or he may be a very problematic person. I certainly don't think that that prevents us from talking about or sharing his ideas or teaching about them. Again, that's another whole conversation to have, but I just want to acknowledge that that's present. I have had people before leave classes that I was giving, not because they disagreed with anything I was saying, which I still think is an interesting reason to leave a class, but because they disagreed with some of the other ideas of people I put on the source sheet. So that's a whole other level of, right, second order boycott. It's not because of what I said, it's because of what somebody else I put on my source sheet said. So I hope that if you're leaving it just because you have something else to do, you're not interested in what I'm saying, but not because this is a secondary boycott of me for quoting Moshe Kapel. Moshe Kapel in Judaism Straight Up talks a lot about the version of Judaism he saw among older Gera Hasidim, older men in a shtibel that he davened in. And he said, for these older Hasidic men, this endless temperature taking and dipsticking and where am I and how do I feel about and how does this all relate to me and how do I connect to was like the farthest thing from their understanding. Judaism was a collective enterprise. It was something you did. It was something you immersed yourself in. It was something you lived. It was something you engaged in collectively along with other people. It wasn't a series of position papers. It wasn't a series of arguments. It wasn't the perpetual taking of my own emotional temperature. Do I feel comfortable with all this? Because if I don't, then I don't agree with it. I think I have to leave because I can't really participate in any undertaking or any community or any organization that I'm not entirely comfortable with every single last piece of. Instead, it's a lived experience and it's a shared, collective, communal lived experience. It's something that we do together. And that is meaningful because we are doing it together. It is something that is viscerally experienced, not intellectually assessed and argued. And it's less about measuring, have I discharged my halachic obligation, and much more about doing the thing together with other people who are doing the thing. And they didn't spend a lot of time saying, these men he's writing about, he says we're all survivors. They didn't spend a lot of time saying, I do believe in God after the Holocaust. I don't believe in God after the Holocaust. They showed up to Shul. They showed up to Minyan. They davened because that's just the thing you do together with other people doing the thing as part of a collective of people doing the thing. I think that's a really interesting idea for us to think about. It takes us away from this atomized, individualistic, late 20th, early 21st century self-assessment. It takes us away from a constant self-absorbed, am I doing this right? Am I feeling this right? That can look like frumkite. I'm worried if I'm feeling the right thing on Tisha B'Av. But what it really can become is a lot of spending a lot of time thinking about myself and assessing myself and in conversation with myself. And instead, it is about connecting to a collective and a whole, being part of something, being engaged with something, and asking less often, am I feeling the exact right thing right now? Is this meaningful for me right now? And instead saying, what does it feel like to be part of this greater whole, all of whom collectively are doing this thing and experiencing this thing together right now? Many of us, I think, have had that experience. Showing up to Eichel last night, sitting on the floor or on a low chair, being in a shul together with a lot of other people, listening to somebody read Eicha and thinking, I don't know what I'm feeling or I'm not feeling. What I'm feeling right now is that I am together with a lot of other people doing this as part of a collective, immersed in this collective. Not as much asking myself, am I feeling this right in this moment of this pasuk and that next pasuk of Eicha? Am I feeling sadness? Am I not feeling sadness? What I'm feeling is part of the thing, part of the bigger thing, part of the whole. I had an interesting experience a number of years ago that I've been talking about ever since. So now I'll talk about it to you. My school faces a large avenue in Riverdale in the Bronx in New York City. And the school has lots and lots of windows. The windows all look out on Riverdale Avenue. So there we are with all of our windows looking out on Riverdale Avenue. I'm trying to teach my class. And all of a sudden I see that all my students, instead of looking at me, they're looking out the window onto Riverdale Avenue. Now, I've been accused of many things as a teacher. I'm not usually accused of being boring. So why are my students all looking out the window and not looking at me? We go out to see, go to the window to look, and we see the police have closed off Riverdale Avenue, and there are hundreds of New York City firefighters in their dressed blue uniforms lined up standing at attention. So usually firefighters wear that black and neon yellow turnout gear, but they're all wearing the navy blue dress uniforms, brass buttons, the little hats. They have the gloves on, standing at attention. And my students all go to the window and I go to the window. We've all given up. I apologize for the noise in the background. Give me 1 second here. Great, we've solved that. They're all standing at the window. The police have closed off the street. The hundreds of firefighters are there. And it becomes clear to us that this is a firefighter's funeral. There's a church across the street from us, a Catholic church, St. Margaret of Cortona. They're holding a funeral at St. Margaret of Cortona. And then one of my colleagues goes and looks up and finds out that the firefighter whose funeral is today, and this is 2016, 2017, had worked at the pile at Ground Zero on 9/11. And he was dying of a cancer that he contracted from his work on the pile. And so even though he's died this 15, 16, whatever it is, years after 9/11, he's considered to be a 9/11 casualty, and he's being buried with the full honors that anybody who died as a 9/11 casualty is being buried with. And so then the funeral cortege comes, and instead of a hearse, they have a historic fire truck from the 1930s to the 1940s carrying the casket. And then, because this is a thing firefighters are very into, apparently the bagpipers come all dressed in their FDNY kilts and the whole get up, bagpiping, and everybody's marching in unison, and everybody's doing exactly the same thing. And all the firefighters on the side are dressed exactly the same way, and everybody's standing there exactly the same way. And it was actually a really powerful moment for me for thinking about how we think about halachic observance and Jewish observance. In ways, I think, that align with what Capel is talking about, which is no one's asking the firefighters to feel or not feel. We're asking you to show up right now, because that's what we do, to be here. And to be here dressed the way you have to be dressed, which is the way that everybody else is dressed. And it doesn't really matter, again, what your personal taste or style or anything else is irrelevant here. We are here to stand here together, to be part of a collective, to be subsumed into a whole, to be doing the same thing together in the same place at the same time. And that's actually what makes it matter. And whether any individual firefighter does or does not know this person who's being buried, does or does not feel personally sad, all that is irrelevant to the collective ritual that's being enacted here. And what's being enacted here is a ritual that we all participate in, that we all are part of. And I think we should start thinking about Tisha B'Av and its practices of mourning, not as the thing that gets us to the thing, but the thing. Meaning, not that the practices of Avelut are the thing that get us to the feeling of Avelut. And if you haven't gotten to the feeling of Avelut, you haven't succeeded or you haven't done it right. And instead, to think about the practices of mourning as the thing. We are together with everybody else doing the practices of mourning, part of this collective, creating a world. I do not live in a majority Jewish or a majority observant community. I actually live in the largest Dominican American community in the United States. So when I walk down the street there on Tisha B'Av, there are lots of people saying hi to me and I say hi back. But then I pass another observant Jew and they nod and I nod, or they don't acknowledge me and I don't acknowledge them, because it's Tisha B'Av and it's what we do. And by engaging in that practice together, we are creating, we're creating a world, we're creating a reality, we're creating a day, we're creating an experience. And that's the thing that we're doing. And I'm not even worried if I'm creating a feeling or I'm not creating a feeling. My children found it very strange walking with me to shul and home from shul and sort of passing these people I know. And then my 11-year-old son asked me, when he sees his friend in shul, can he say hi? I said, you're really not supposed to say hi. He said, can I say his name? Can I say Tzvi? I said, yeah, I think you could say tzvi. When you walk up to tzvi and shul, he said tzvi. But that actually creates a reality. Whether my son is feeling sad about the Chorban Beit HaMikdash or not, the fact that things are different and we're all experiencing them differently together, and that's the thing is the thing. So I see somebody in the chat wrote, so empty ritual, and that is great. Thank you for raising that, because that's exactly where I'm going. Because the next place to go is the question of empty ritual. So let's go right there. Right? So I just said do it. Don't worry about feeling it. Don't get so hung up on what you're feeling. And let the doing it be the thing. And somebody in the chat box asked if that's just empty ritual. I promise you I'm getting the question empty ritual in about 3 minutes, but hold that thought. I want to say a couple more things before I get the question of empty ritual. The first thing is I want to just be very clear, even before we move on to talk about the next thing, that I don't think the doing of it without feeling is empty ritual. And I want to reiterate that before I move on to talk about the next thing. And I'll tell you why. Because it creates a world, because it creates an experience, because it creates a reality. I don't know if I can feel sadness for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. I can feel part of a Jewish community where all of us are enacting this and remembering this. And that in itself is a remarkable thing. Perhaps because I'm a historian by training. I sat today and explained, so I just told you about my 11-year-old son, now I'll tell you about my almost 14-year-old daughter. I sat today and explained to my almost 14-year-old daughter the Kina Sha'ali Srufa Ba'esh by the Maharam Rottenberg, right? Which many of us probably heard explained this morning. Rabbi Meir of Rottenberg saw the burning of the Talmud in Paris in the 1240s as a very young man. And he wrote this Kina, this mourning poem, not for the death of people and not for the massacre of a community, but for the destruction of the cartloads of the Talmud that King Louis had burned in Paris, which led to the destruction of the great houses of study in France. The idea that we as a people, almost 800 years later, are sitting on the floor and remembering an event that happened in the 1240s and mourning the destruction of our holy books, to me is an incredibly powerful thing about who we are as a people, even if I don't feel the sadness that the Maharam felt. And so I want to be very clear that before I answer the empty ritual point and speak in praise of empty ritual, which I'm about to, I just want to say that I don't think this is empty ritual. And I think that's what Kapel was saying in his book, Judaism Straight Up. I think he's saying the doing of it creates a reality. It creates an experience. It creates an immersion. It creates a totality. And it's not, did I check the box? I did the thing. I checked the box. I got the sticker. Tick the box. If there's anybody from the UK, I don't know. Canadians check boxes or tick boxes. British people definitely do not check boxes. They tick them. It's not just I check the box. It's I am part of this collective experience. But having said that, since I just made a strong statement in favor of not worrying about the feelings it's evoking or not, I now want to address the question of ritual. Because it all comes back to Torah in motion, I first learned about this scholar and this scholarship from Dr. Alana Stein-Hain, who spoke earlier today. And if you're a person of great zitzfleisch and patience, you might have been here straight through the whole day, perseverance, persistence, whatever the word is, you might have been straight through all day. I don't think, based on her title, that this is what Dr. Stein-Hain spoke about today, but she was the first person I learned this from. And this is the work of a scholar named Adam Seligman. So, of course, because it's a very small world, I was speaking at a shul near Boston, and I cited Professor Seligman, and they said to me, oh, you know, he's a member of our shul. I said, no, really didn't have any idea. Didn't know he was a member of the observant community. Just knew that I love his work. And he does a lot of academic scholarship about ritual. He writes about ritual. And if I can now, I'm going to share my screen. We're going to see if this works and share with you a couple of things that he has to say about ritual. Let's see if that works. Yes, it does. Look at us here. Okay. So I have two different selections here from Dr. Seligman about ritual that I want us to look at. Maybe we won't look at all of them quite, but let's look at some of it. Great. He says, relationships in which you say, I can never pretend, and I can never act, and I can never be in a state of not authenticity in any moment are not going to do so well. Anti-ritualist attitudes deny the value to the subjunctive of play, convention, and illusion. They seek to root interaction in some attestations of the sincerity of the interlocutors. But if we can only talk in a way that is the most true and authentic self, we can all imagine this in relationships we've been in, we can sometimes find ourselves heading into less than great directions, okay? And therefore, sometimes we say things that we don't entirely mean to enact the ritual of a relationship. Thus, for example, we can in the end distinguish two forms of the words, I love you. The emotionally wrought confession by the starstruck young man appeals to the sincere mode. So those most intense moments of feeling, you just fell in love, you're walking your child down to the chuppah, the baby was just born, whatever the most intense moments of feeling are, and you're overwhelmed by a feeling of love and you say, I love you then, that is an I love you that is a sincere and authentic I love you. Okay? But perhaps he's indeed sincere and having established this as is of his love, will never feel the need to say those words again, even through decades of marriage. He may also fail to say those words ever again because he is not sincerely experiencing the same kind of love as when he first fell in love. So could we imagine that? Someone who says, I said I love you so sincerely in a moment of such deeply held feeling, I can never say it again unless I'm feeling the same level of deeply held feeling. In which case, you would not say I love you terribly often. And that relationship in the years and decades that go by without ever saying I love you because no, I must be authentic and I can only say I love you when I feel it as strongly as I did the moment we first fell in love, or saying to your child, I know how I felt overcome with love when you were born, and until I feel that again, I'm not saying I love you again. That relationship would really be starved and would wither. On the other hand, we also have the ritual I love you, whose performative aspect is more important than its denotative function. This is why one can repeat it for years and years to the same person. In so doing, one is not adding any bit of hitherto unknown information, but instead acting out a ritual rather in the manner of a prayer. So before we go to the second source, what Seligman is saying here about ritual is that ritual is not about empty and meaningless. Ritual is about evoking. So there is a time when I feel that intense love, and then there are other times when I don't actually feel it the same way, but the ritual of saying I love you every time before I hang up the phone evokes that feeling. It evokes it for me and it evokes it for the person I'm speaking to. Both of us are brought back to that moment of when that feeling was so heightened and was so intense and was so authentic and so felt. And even if it isn't right now, even if I just said, could you get me a dozen eggs and a gallon, half a gallon of milk on the way home. And then I say, I love you. And nobody's having such an intense feeling around that. But it evokes how we felt when we felt that very intense feeling. We actually say that at the end of Shalit Rifava Eish, since I talked about that, we ask if it can sort of bring back Ahavat Klulotayach, like the love of the bridal days. Maybe the Torah can go re-arouse in God those feelings that were once felt but are clearly not being felt right now. And maybe we can get back to that. And if we think about a ritual not as it's empty and meaningless if I'm not authentically feeling this right now, but it is evoking and it is reminding me and is putting me in the frame of mind of this is what I felt, or this is what one could feel, or this is what it could look like to feel this, then I think we think very differently about that ritual practice and the ritual observance. And I think it's really striking that Seligman says right at the end of that passage that I read you, that it's in the manner of a prayer. Because I think that many of us, this experience I'm talking about Tisha B'Av and I'm not feeling it, which I said to you, people don't have about V'samachta B'chagecha. People don't say, I'm not really feeling joy in Chag, am I doing it right? Another place where I think many people experience this is when it comes to tefillah, when it comes to prayer. I'm not feeling anything, I'm saying the words. Even the words I say every day, even if they're not as hard as the words of the keynote, even if I know what they mean, the repetition of Shema, I don't know that every day I'm feeling transported in a state of intense emotion or kavana or connection or spirituality or transportation or transformation. And what this is saying is not that that's a failed tefillah. If you don't think about that as a failed tefillah, but instead if you think about it as there are two kinds of tefillah. There is that I love you at the beginning of the relationship. I love you when the child is born. I love you when I walk the child down to the chuppah, which is the intensely felt emotion. And then there is the other statement of I love you, which evokes that without being that. And that sustains the relationship until we get to the next high point of I love you. And then you think about it very differently. So I want to show you that in the next selection from Seligman. So let's go back there for a minute. First, we claim that ritual creates a subjunctive, an as if or could be universe. It is this very creative act that makes our shared social world possible. We create a shared as if, he says. So what's an example of that shared as if? As if, whenever the expressions please and thank you are used, when we ask a casual acquaintance, how are you? Both knowing in advance that we do not really expect an honest answer, we are enacting a ritual for the maintenance of our shared social world. When I say thank you, do I really feel gratitude? Probably most of the time I don't. I am acting as if I feel gratitude to maintain our shared social world. When I say to somebody, how are you and how are you doing? Okay. And then he moves on to contrast ritual modes of behavior with sincere modes of behavior, but not in the sense that sincere modes are the correct or right or proper ones, and the ritual modes are the wrong or failed or improper ones. Instead, he says, ritual modes of behavior can be usefully contrasted to what we term sincere forms of approaching the world. Sincere viewers are focused not on the creation of an as if, a shared subjunctive. Instead, they project an as is. This is what it really is. The tropes of sincerity are pervasively with us in both our personal and our shared social world. They appear in the arrogances of what are termed fundamentalist religious belief. They are present in our overwhelming concern with authenticity, with individual choice, with the belief that if we can only get at the core, the fount, the unalterable and inimitable heart of what we really feel or really think, then all will be well, if not with the world, then at least with ourselves. And so this idea of the as if and the as is to say that sometimes it is what it is. We are really feeling that right now, and that is the as is. But when it is not, the as if of ritual gets us to evoke it, gets us to remember when we might have felt it. If neither of those things is true, gets us to project it. It gets us to create an as if world. And so I think that's a second way of thinking about what it means to go through Tisha B'Av, maybe not feeling the feelings of mourning without thinking that my Tisha B'Av has failed or hasn't succeeded. It is to say, it hasn't failed. You have experienced a ritual which evokes for you the practices of mourning. This is what you would do if this isn't as if you were mourning, if you were actually feeling it. This is how you would conduct yourself. You'd speak in a low voice and you wouldn't greet people and you would sit on the floor and you wouldn't eat and drink and you wouldn't anoint yourself. And these are all the things we would and would not do if we were in a state of mourning. And by enacting the ritual, we are evoking the as if of that state, whether or not it is our current as is. Here's the third thing I want to say about doing the rituals of Tisha B'Av without meaning them, perhaps, or without feeling them. Let's not say without meaning them. Let's say without feeling them. I think without feeling them is a better way of describing it. And that is attention to detail of any kind in any context is how we express that something matters to us. When something matters to us, we pay attention to whatever the details are and to getting them right. Anytime anyone says, oh, it's no big deal, the only thing they're saying is I don't care that much about it. Nobody is laid back about the things they care about. Doesn't matter what are the things you care about. Nobody is laid back about the things they care about. But the things I really care about, those have to be done precisely and correctly. And if it's, you know, whether my team got unfair calls by the referee in sports or whether it's the details of observance of halacha, or it's about how my outfit has to be arranged exactly just so. Whatever is the specific thing that I care and how I make my coffee, whatever is the specific thing that I care intensely about, when I care intensely about something, I care about the details. Saying, oh, I'm laid back, I don't really care that much about it, doesn't really tell me about your character as a person. It only tells me about how much you care about this particular activity. Because activities that we care about and that we're deeply invested in, we pay attention to the detail. And there's something else to me about the laws of Tisha B'Av, or really about any experience of halachic living, which is that by paying attention to the details of it, we are conveying the importance and the gravity of the day. And that's not the same thing as feeling a sense of mourning, and I acknowledge that. But there is a way in which I am not going to do activity X and I am not going to do activity Y and I am going to conduct myself in way Z and I am not going to say this in Shachrit in the morning, but I am going to say this in Mincha in the afternoon. all of which are paying attentions, are noticing. And when things matter to us, we notice. And when things matter to us, we pay attention. And so there's something else to say about the observance of the day, even if I'm not feeling it, which is that even if I'm not feeling a sense of mourning, I am acknowledging the importance and the weight and the gravity and the significance of the day by all the manifold ways in which I pay attention to the required practices of the day. And of course, this is true about every year of halachic observance. I think about a lot of halacha this way, that in paying attention to detail, we are saying that something matters and we are making it matter. I have to stop and think, how do I do this and how can I do this, right? For me, it's always the hand washing. Shabbat. I don't know why for me that's so much harder than any other observance of the day. I've never forgotten and eaten by mistake on the ninth of Av. I forget and wash my hands the wrong way all the time. I have to like stop when I'm washing my hands and pay attention to what I'm doing and make sure I'm doing it right. Now, you know, eating and drinking is much more onerous. In my 25 hours of not eating and drinking is much more uncomfortable than how I wash my hands or I don't. But for some reason, that's the thing that takes much more attention paying on my part. And when I pay attention that way, what I'm saying is this day matters, this observance matters, this historical memory matters, this mourning matters. And even if I'm not feeling it emotionally, affectively myself right now, I'm acknowledging its import in a way I think that goes from, it's not just a meaningful ritual of hand washing. It's actually a statement of significance. It's a statement of how much I recognize this matters to me individually and to the Jewish people collectively as our shared historical memory. And if I'm doing that, then for me, the question of whether or not I'm feeling it is not, and I will just say that while I say for me, and I say that as an educator and as a parent of teenagers, and as somebody who deals a lot of the time with people who feel the guilt or distress about, I'm not feeling it, I must not be doing it right. This is a question that's discussed widely in halacha, right? What does the halacha want of us? Does it want actions? Does it want performance? Does it want heartfelt? This conversation goes all the way back to our earliest sources, goes back to the Gemara. Do mitzvot require intention? Do they require kavanah? God wants the heart. Rachmana liba bae. Is it enough if I do the action of mitzvot without paying any attention? If I walk past a shul where they're blowing shofar and I don't intend to hear the shofar, am I yotzei my obligation of hearing shofar? So these conversations are very present conversations, go on for a very long time. But I found very striking, and with this I'll close, and then I will open the floor for questions or look through some of what's come in the chat, is it makes sense for us maybe, or it's more understandable for us in the realm of if I walk past a shul and they're blowing shofar and I didn't have intention, the question of is intention necessary, which is not precisely the same thing as this feeling necessary, but it's in the same boat. Is it just the actions or some internal emotional state that governs whether I've discharged my obligation? So with shofar, okay, that's shofar, but clearly mourning is a very different thing. And here's the interesting thing I just discovered. This conversation absolutely comes up even in the laws of Avelut as well. And not just the Avelut Yishtana that the Rav talked about, the Rav Salvechik talked about, of the destruction of Beit HaMikdash or the tragedies that befell the Jewish people, but even in the Avelut Chadasha in the new morning. So I am a participant in, a student in, a learner in Midrashat Lindenbaum's International Halacha Scholars Program for Women, which is a wonderful program of serious and intense text-based halacha learning for women, which is a four-year program. And we've just finished the second year of. And so I am now doing review and study for my comprehensive, my final exam in Avelut. We learned Avelut the last half of the year. I have to take an Avelut exam by the end of July, which is nigh upon us. And so my chavruta and I have been reviewing over Zoom. Well, we always learn over Zoom, have been reviewing for the test on Avelut. And in the course of studying the halachot of Avelut on Chol HaMoed and on Yom Tov, and can you do certain practices of Avelut on Chol HaMoed, or is the, or on Yom Tov, or is the action of Avelut completely dissonant with the chag on which you are commanded to be happy? And I think for many of us, we know that reality, that Shiva is suspended by Chag, and also that it can be exceptionally difficult for people who are in that state of Avelut Chadasha and are feeling that intense emotional state of mourning to navigate being told that the mourning is suspended. But here in the question of can people continue to do certain practices of Avelut, or does it conflict with what's going on all around them, the experience of the Chag? There is one opinion that actually says that no, we continue doing the practices of mourning because the only thing that's commanded during the period of mourning is the actions of mourning and not the feeling. And so you can continue to do the actions of mourning, even if you are still commanded in a Torah commandment to feel the joy of the Chag. I'm not telling you that's the majority opinion or dispositive opinion or the opinion that carries the day. But even as a minority opinion, it was fascinating to see somebody who says that even when it comes to Avelut Chadasha, the new mourning, the mourning of a personal loss, not just Avelut Yishana, the Avelut of the Beit HaMikdash of our collective Jewish suffering, that what is being commanded is a set of actions, not a set of emotions, and that one can discharge one's obligation by doing the actions, irrespective of the emotions that may or may not be evoked by those actions. And again, we think about this in this context of our collective communal mourning. I think it was really interesting to see it show up even in the context of an individual and a personal mourning. A number of years ago, a former colleague of mine at SAR High School, who now works elsewhere in the Jewish educational world, Yair Dar, posted something on Twitter leading into Tisha B'Av. And he said, don't sweat it. Don't worry if you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong. Just do the thing. Do the Tisha B'Av. The right way to do Tisha B'Av is to do Tisha B'Av. Is to be in it. Is to have that embodied sense of it. That physical, experiential, live. I'm sitting on the floor and it doesn't feel great. I'm not eating and it doesn't feel great. I'm paying attention to how I wash my hands. That embodied, physical, lived, experienced part of it. And do that together with the collective, with the community, with everybody else doing it around you. Do it to show that there's something bigger here and something important and something we remember and something we connect to. Do it to show there's something we pay attention to, we notice, we care about, that matters. And whether or not we are emotionally stirred to tears during the keynote, during the recitation of Eicha, during the things we're reading or the things we're watching, by being part of the shared collective experience, by being part of the lived, embodied, physical experience, by being part of a ritual that we all do to evoke an as is, and sorry, an as if, even if it isn't right now, our as is, then whether or not we are feeling feelings of avelut, whether or not we are feeling feelings of mourning or sadness, we're doing Tisha B'Av right. So now let's see what questions look like. I'll start with the last one. Lisa says that sometimes she feels that these Tisha B'Av programs get in the way of feeling the avelut. And I think that's a perfectly valid thing to say. And I think that spending some time in the day, right? The Pasuk says to us, Yeshev Badad V'Yidom, you will sit alone and be silent. There's something to be said for sitting alone and being silent. And it's true, there's a lot to learn and there's a lot to hear. And there's a lot to distract ourselves from, but sometimes Yeshev Badad V'Yidom is valuable. A lot of discussion about the grammar of the subjunctive. An anonymous user says, a holiday once interrupted your salvagic's mourning as a halacha command. He stated he had to go from a state of mourning to a state of simcha because halacha commands it. Not easy to do, yet maybe made easier by the community participating as a whole in your mourning or your happiness, fake until you make it. I want to say again, this is very clearly how Rav Salvagic engages and views the world, and also that I want to suggest that there are other possible approaches. It is an extremely tall order to say to somebody, you have to stop feeling sadness and start feeling joy. It is maybe more for somebody who is in a state of new mourning. It is maybe easier to say to somebody, you have to stop doing the actions of sadness and start doing the actions of joy. You have to stop the avel. It's a little bit different than immersing yourself in a community because the avel is in certain ways pulling apart for the community. You have to re-engage with the community because now we are doing actions as if we felt joy, even if that is not your as is. So yes, it is very clear that Rav Salvagic is talking about getting oneself to a place where one actually experiences this affectively, where one experiences this emotionally. And I want to talk about how we think about and relate to it when we don't get to that point and aren't getting to that point. Okay. Esther, thank you so much for raising this point at the end here. You discussed the importance of being part of a community. Can you comment on the fact that feeling part of a community would be much harder for women who have fewer communal obligations and opportunities? Because what I forgot to say is that that is one of the things that bothers me the most about Judaism Straight Up by Moshe Kappel. Because that experience, that live, that just do the thing and be part of the community, people doing the thing and don't spend so much time navel-gazing and self-assessing that he describes his Gerach Hasidim as doing, that's accessible to his Gerach Hasidim and that's accessible to him. But it's really not as accessible to me in the same way. And I didn't think his book engaged that at all. And to the extent that there are women in his book, he has a foil, some super liberal Jew on a college campus. And she's, of course, a woman. And she's sort of the foil to the men who are doing it right. And that pushed a few buttons. But the bigger question, I think, is an important question. And I don't think the answer is to say, I'm a modern Orthodox Jew. I think the answer is to say we have to figure out what it looks like for women to have and feel community in the Jewish community. Understanding both that in the Orthodox world, women don't count in a minyan and aren't going to be called up to the Torah and shul and things like that. And also the lived reality that even if you do, as my shul does, a 10:30 Eicha reading for, right, some parent has to be home with the baby and it's more likely going to be the mother who's home with the baby while the father goes to Marav and Eicha. So there's a 10:30 Eicha reading. And I imagine that there are many people who are parenting young children who are listening to this and thinking, do not do me any favors. After a long day of parenting my baby or my running around after my toddler, you are now going to afford me the opportunity to go to Eicha at 10:30 at night. I'm not sure that that's right, exactly what I needed. And so that is part of this reality of how we do Tisha B'Av, that for some people, it may be sitting on the floor at home and saying keynote at home and thinking about how I eat and I don't eat at home. I will absolutely acknowledge that if you are home with small children, feeling any of this is much, much harder. I am past that stage of life. My youngest is 11. There were absolutely years when Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur was a day at home chasing kids around and trying not to pass out. And that was the extent, you know, that was, there wasn't much more of an experience of the day than that. I don't know who R. Mendez is, but I would appreciate your elaborating on what you mean. Women with kids can feel this with no problem. It's harder for single women. Rabbi Kelman, I don't know if people are.
Yeah, able to I don't know either, but I'm going to assume what she means is that a woman who's married can feel part of a community. You go for Shabbos meals, friendly, but single woman, you know, and a single man can go to minyan, go to shul. The single woman, it's even much harder. I assume that's what you mean, but I obviously don't know. But you can comment on that if you'd like.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to that, I'm not going to dispute the truth of that when it comes to community generally. I live in a community that may be a little bit of an outlier in this regard, in which there is a lot of regular shul going, regular communal participation and community building and creating by adults who aren't married. But it's also true that my community has many, many, many adults. That's probably a majority of the community. And so it's different than feeling like you're a sort of add-on in someone else's community. But I want to talk now about the question of halachic participation, right? We were not talking in general, that's an important conversation to have, but wasn't the conversation we're having today. We were talking more specifically about the experience of being part of a halachic observance. And in that sense, I think anybody who can go to shul and be part of a Tisha B'Av day in a shul, in a community, can feel themselves part of this. And people who, for whatever reason, it might be their own health, are not able to do that and participate. They are staying at home in bed all day on a fast day, might have a harder time feeling that sense of collectivity and community than people who can be in shul. The advent of Zoom has afforded opportunities for connection to the events of the day in ways that are probably both beneficial and challenging, meaning there are many people who participate in the events of Tisha B'Av who would not otherwise have been able to. And also then you may find yourself passing an entire day sitting alone in your house and still not feeling the sense of being part of a broader communal gathering that you would have been if you're not on Zoom. So that ability to move our ritual lives and our religious lives, at least in part, onto Zoom is probably a mixed blessing in some ways, and worth thinking about. But the subsuming ourselves in something bigger than ourselves, which I think is really a great deal of what the entire enterprise of being an observant Jew is, not just my own personal that I fulfill my obligations, I'm absolutely acknowledging that it is harder for some of us than for others. It is harder for some members of our, there are many different people within our broader community who, for one reason or another, have a harder time finding their place within the social and halachic community that is Orthodoxy. And I absolutely want to acknowledge that. And at the same time, I want to encourage all of us to seek out in the ways we can and the places we can that communal experience, and to think about our Judaism, not only about my own observance and that I do what I needed to do, but how do I experience this together again, together with the collective of the Jewish people, experiencing something that is important and that matters and I give importance to, by the way, I pay attention to it, in which if I'm not feeling it right now as is, I am experiencing it as if, and which I'm not paying as much attention to myself and my own individual emotional experience and more attention to the collective that I'm a part of.
All right, anybody else? Any other?
If I may say, just being on a series of classes where there have been over 300 participants is really already feeling that you're part of a community, even if you're not in shul, even if you didn't get to hear Echa. To me, when I was looking and clicking on the number of participants and saw those numbers, I mean, that fulfills it in a way too. So thank you.
If I may interject a thought here, I'll give Rabbi Kelman a little time to catch his breath before he speaks next. I totally agree with what this lady just said. But I also want to get back to the idea that we heard a minute ago about sometimes it's good to sit alone and do your thing by yourself. And I was doing that this morning because I could not go to shul. And I had a reaction that is very unusual for me. I actually burst into tears when I was saying kinos. And the reason is because I put two things together, which involve not only the Jewish community, but the world community. Namely, that women, you know, that children were begging their mothers for food and they couldn't get, the mothers had no food to give them on the one hand. And then we come to the kina, which says, why are you complaining to God? You know, you caused this by yourself. And it made me think about the issues of global warming that are going on in the world today. And I think that a fast day is also a day when we're supposed to be introspective and try to improve ourselves personally. And I think this is an issue that is not mentioned enough. And I don't know, you know, maybe I'm being naive here, but I think we're in certain parts of the world, we're already there. And 20 years from now, unless something drastically changes, a lot more of us are going to be there. And then what are we going to say to God that, you know, it's your fault? It's not God's fault. It's going to be our fault. And that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Press, you want to add, Rivka, you want to add anything? Or that? Well, thank you. I know you're speaking half an hour at Mount Sinai on the 187th and Broadway. And thank you. It's always a pleasure to learn with you and to learn from you. And I definitely agree. I was going to write it before, but I didn't. There's no doubt that organizing these programs brings me great joy. And I don't know what I'd do on Tisha B'Av without them. And I know that's not exactly the halachic framework, but it's okay. If that's the worst halach I'm violating, I'm in good shape. So there is no doubt, like I mentioned before, this learning, you know, this new style, even explaining keynote. I think I don't know how old everybody is here, but I think pretty much all of us, when we were kids, they didn't explain keynote and shul. They mumbled them through and nobody. Today we say, I did the explanation to my shul this morning for a keynote, and I would have gone longer, but I had to get back for 11 o'clock for shulim mission class. So in an hour and 40 minutes, we did like seven keynotes, like, you know, cause you go through them. They're so beautiful, actually, the meaning, and, Tisha B'Av has changed. And I agree. Thank you, Siri, for that comment with all the people. I do sense that's what we try to do. There's a sense of community. It's not exactly the same, but there is definitely, we call it our global Beit Midrash, our virtual Beit Midrash. Thank you, Josh. And then Baruch Hashem, we got people from Israel, California, New York, Chicago, Boston, everywhere. It's thank you. I want to thank all of you for coming. And thank you, Dr. Rivka. And we can take a 2-minute break. And then I guess I don't want to say Akron Akron Chavi. That's not fair. But I guess I put myself for last because it's harder on people. And anybody who's been here now for 7 hours, I said, I don't know if I really mean it. Maybe I do. I hope I do. You'll get a prize after 8 hours, a free dinner. We'll have to supply you one time. So I'm going to stretch for 1 minute before I can start, and then we'll be back and we'll continue with the last hour. Thank you. And thank you. Okay.